Chapter 7. Philip Gates arrived at Dev's apartment promptly at 8. He took one look at Dev and frowned.
God, Dev, you look awful. What's wrong?
I haven't slept, that's all, said Dev. That and the anxiety.
Over what? What's so bad that you can't tell me over the phone?
I want you to listen to something, Dev said, conducting Gates to the den where his program was set up.
What is it? Is it the program?
Yeah, sit down. Y'all want a drink?
Sure, why not?
Dev got out the bottle of scotch he'd gone out and bought 20 minutes earlier.
I've been working with the program, he said, conducting therapy sessions with it, as much as I've done with Steel. Only this time, I've done something different. For a while now, I've had the nagging feeling that there was something bothering Steel, something he wasn't telling me. Steel doesn't like psychiatrists very much. The two of us get along okay. We've managed to establish a rapport of sorts, but he's never given up completely and been completely comfortable with me. He keeps his guard up. He handled Gates' drink. At first, I thought it was because he was a strike force cop, Dev continued. They're evaluated constantly by psychiatrists and internal affairs. They see a lot of dangerous duty, and they're often under great stress. And since an IAD doctor can have them removed from duty, either temporarily or permanently, they learn to be very cautious during their evaluations. And they spend so much time with shrinks that they get good at playing the game and keeping their defenses up. I thought Steele's antipathy towards psychiatrists was a result of that, but I didn't want to take anything for granted, so I've been doing some careful checking into his background.
And what did you find out? Asked Gates.
Steele's mother was killed when he was just a boy, said Dev. It must have been a tremendously traumatic experience for him. She was a hospital nurse, and she became infected with virus 3 when she came in contact with a sample of contaminated blood. She became a screamer, and she came home to her family and attacked her children. Steele was spared, but she managed to keep his two younger brothers before his father could help and stop her. She apparently bit them repeatedly, and they were both infected with the virus. Steele's father struggled with her and was finally forced to shoot her, but not before he became infected himself. So to spare his sons the agonies of becoming screamers, he shot them both and then turned the gun on himself. Steele witnessed the whole thing.
Jesus!
Gates said.
Steele became a ward of the state, said Dev. And after what happened, he spent some time in hospital psychiatric ward. It seems the doctor who worked with him was somewhat heavy-handed. Steele blocked out most of what happened to his family, and his therapist worked pretty hard to make him confront it. Apparently, too hard. He was successful, but Steele had a dislike of psychiatrists ever since. And though we've made some good progress, when it comes to certain things, he just won't open up. And if I tried to force the issue, it would only make things worse.
I see your point, said Gates. So what's all this leading up to?
After I started working with the backup program you gave me, Dev said, I began encountering the same problem. So I had a long talk with Dr. Nakamura. She showed me how to write in an imperative that could circumvent Steele's reluctance to open up, sort of like a computer version of a hypnosis. In a way, that would force the program to respond. Steele would never have agreed to anything like that, of course, and I had some misgivings about whether or not I should do it with the program. I'm not at all certain about what the ethics are for the situation, but I figured, in the end, that if it would help Steele, it was worth a try. So I went ahead and did it. He went over to the computer and booted up the program. I want you to listen to this and tell me what you think, he said. Don't say anything. Just listen. He switched on the voice synthesizer and the microphone. Steele? Can you hear me? Steele's voice came from the speaker.
Yes, I can hear you.
Dev switched off the mic for a moment.
He thinks he's under mild sedation, he explained. It's what I told them to explain why he can't see or feel anything. He doesn't realize that he's only a backup program. I decided not to tell him that because I didn't want to agitate him.
Gates frowned. Cooper was talking about the program as if it were alive and self-aware, but it was only a computer program. Data. Mental engrams. He didn't think it was possible for it to become agitated. Dev switched on the mic again.
I'd like to talk about your dream again, he said. You know, the recurring one you told me about before?
There was a slight pause.
Okay.
I'd like to go over it one more time from the beginning, Dev said. Tell me about it.
Another slight pause, albeit a bit longer this time.
Well, I'm in the park.
Central Park?
I don't know. It's just a park, I guess. It could be Central Park, I suppose, but I'm not really sure.
Okay, go on.
Gates put down his drink and leaned forward with interest. The program was not responding at all the way he had expected it to. In his work with it, he had never actually spoken with it the way Dev was doing now. He had worked with it on a display screen, pulling out certain sections of data and examining it, programming it into Steel's cybernetic brain as separate files designed to interface with one another. He never actually communicated with the program directly or tried to examine the subconscious engrams in detail. There had been no reason to do so, and it simply never occurred to him.
"Well, I have to park,"
the program continued, responding in Steel's voice.
"And my family's with me. The kids are playing with the dog. My wife is sitting on the blanket, saying at our picnic lunch, oh, there's something wrong."
Another pause. "Go on," prompted Dev. "What's wrong?" The program hesitated once more.
"We never had a dog,"
the program said.
"We only have two kids, Jason and Corey. But in the dream, I've got three kids, two boys and a girl. The boys are twins. They're calling me Daddy. I don't know what any of their names are."
"You don't know or you can't remember?" Dev asked.
"I don't know. I mean, I don't know which it is. I suppose I can't remember. Because at first, I couldn't remember my wife's name either. Only now I can. It's Donna."
"But I thought your wife's name was Janice," Dev said.
"It was. I mean, it is. And that's another thing. Janice was a blonde. This woman's a brunette. And she doesn't look anything like Janice. Her name is Donna, but that's all I know about her. I don't know who she is."
"But you referred to her as your wife," said Dev.
"I know. That's the part that makes no sense. I'm there with her, with the kids, and I feel that she's my wife, and they're my kids. But I don't know them."
"Okay, go on. What happens next?"
"The kids are playing, tossing a frisbee with the dog. The dog is jumping up and catching it in its mouth. I don't know the dog's name either, but it seems like it's my dog. It's very confusing. And suddenly, my mother's there."
"You know her?" said Dev.
"Yeah, it's my real mother. She just appears suddenly out of nowhere. And it's dark, late evening, I'd say. A second ago, it was daylight. Now it's dark. It just changed all of a sudden."
"But you're still in the park."
"Yeah, I'm still in the park. What does your mother look like?" "Same way she ever looked when I was just a kid. Last time I ever saw her, she's a screamer. She's got running sores all over her face. Her clothes are all torn up and filthy, like she's been clawing at them. She looks terrible. She starts attacking the kids. It's horrible."
"Your two brothers?" Dev asked.
No, the twins. And the little girl. She's screaming. She's biting them. My wife is screaming my name."
"What name?" said Dev, suddenly alert.
"My name."
"What name is she screaming? Can you hear the name? Tell me the name." Gates was gripping the arms of his chair tightly.
I don't."
"What name is she screaming? Listen to her. Tell me what you hear."
"John. Jonathan. She's screaming, Jonathan."
"Is that you?" asked Dev. "Are you Jonathan?"
I don't want to think about this anymore."
"We're almost finished," Dev said. "Just tell me, are you Jonathan?"
"No, I don't know who Jonathan is. But she's screaming at me, and I can't move. And she, that's it. There isn't any more."
"But there is more, isn't there?" asked Dev.
"I'm tired. I want to go to sleep."
"Just tell me the rest of the dream."
"I can't. I don't remember. That's all there is. Can't I go back to sleep now?"
"Okay," said Dev. "That's all for now. Go back to sleep." He turned off the mic and quit the program. Gates was looking at him intently.
"I don't know what the hell to make of that," he said. "You said this has happened before?"
"We've been over the dream several times now," Dev said, "but just now was the first time we got the name Jonathan. That's something new. We're making progress." Gates looked worried.
"Hell, I wouldn't call that progress," he said. "It doesn't make any sense. There must be some sort of glitch in the program."
"I don't think so," Dev said. "At least, not a glitch in the way you think of it. Something's definitely wrong. That much is true, but it's not a glitch. You put it there."
"I put it there?" said Gates.
"That's right," said Dev. "When you downloaded the data from Steel's organic brain, you compensated for the damage resulting from his injuries with data you downloaded from other individuals with previous experiments. You incorporated that data into Steel's mental engrams. What I believe is happening
is that the data is now expressing itself through the subconscious. Steele's mental engrams have essentially been contaminated in the programming by the mental engrams of other individuals, and he is now manifesting traces of these memories. At least one of them, anyway. His brain is being haunted by cybernetic ghosts. That's impossible, said Gates.
You just heard it, Dev said.
There's got to be some other explanation, Gates said, shaking his head. The auxiliary data was carefully incorporated into the engram matrix. It was designated to facilitate his emotional responsibility. He can't be experiencing direct sensory impressions downloaded from other test subjects. We only used bits and pieces of various other engram files. Apparently, that was enough, Dev said. You simply can't break down the subconscious the way you can a computer data, Phil. It's too complex, too ethereal. You told me yourself that this was an exact duplicate of the data Steele was programmed with. That means that if it's in there, it's in Steele's cybernetic brain. This is what he's been keeping from me. He's been having that dream. He's been experiencing the memories of at least one of the other test subjects whose mental engrams were used to complete his matrix. Possibly what he's experiencing is some sort of composite memory fragment. I really have no way of knowing, and I have no way of knowing if this process will continue. It's possible his personality may be fragmented.
Does Higgin know about this? Asked Gates.
Dev shook his head. I haven't told him yet. Frankly, I'm not sure if I should. Technically, I suppose I'm breaching the confidentiality of the doctor-patient relationship by telling you, but I need some help with this, and I don't know what else to do.
Dev, that's just a program, Gates said. You're not breaking confidentiality. It's not a patient, for God's sake. It's only data.
Is it? Dev asked. That data, as you call it, happens to be Steele's personality. The sum total of who and what he is. It's his identity. His exact duplicate. An electronic clone. And it's alive. Perhaps not in the same sense as you or I am alive, but it's alive just the same. You heard it. It's self-aware. It's Steele's exact twin. It merely lacks a body. You've been working with artificial intelligence programs for so long, Phil, that you failed to tend to think of Steele's mental engrams as nothing but a very sophisticated AI program. But it's not. It isn't artificial intelligence. It's real intelligence. A human personality translated into software. While I was talking to it, asking it questions, it hesitated. Computer programs don't hesitate. It was functioning under a programmed imperative, and it was still hesitating. It was fighting me, especially right near the end. Does a computer program say, I don't want to talk about it when you ask it a question? Even the most sophisticated AI program?
No,
said Gates softly.
It doesn't. It can't.
Only this one can, said Dev. I don't think you fully realize the implications of what you did when you made this backup copy for me. What happens when it finds out that it's not Steele, but merely an electronic clone in a computer? What do I tell it? What do I do, Phil? And what happens if we erase it? Won't that be murder?
You're overreacting, Gates said. How can it be murder? It's not really alive in any traditional sense. Was its birth when we made the copy?
I don't know, said Dev. Maybe it was.
Nonsense. You've been pushing yourself way too hard, Dev. You've been carried away with this whole thing. You've got to step back from it and relax. Try to get some rest.
How can I? Dev said, sitting down with a heavy sigh and picking up his drink. I'm breaking entirely new ground here, Phil, and I haven't got a thing to guide me. We've taken a man's personality, his very soul, and we've made a copy of it. Think of what that means.
Damn, it's only data. It isn't only data. That is a human personality.
Is a human personality just to you all data? That's Steele in there, and Steele's a human being. He isn't a machine.
Isn't he? Said Gates.
Look, Dev, between you, me, and the walls here, the bottom line is that Steele died. He died. You understand what I'm saying? He was a vegetable, and he died the minute we removed his brain. Brain death is legally considered death, Dev. You can't keep the bottom alive with life support machines. But once the brain is gone, that's it. Nobody's home. It's finished. We took Steele's body, augmented it with mechanical parts,
implanted a cybernetic brain and programmed it with data we downloaded from his mind. But it's only data, Dev. Steel is a machine that's partly flesh and blood. That's true. His body still has organic functions, but it's essentially no different from what it was on our life support system when he was still in a coma. It isn't human, Dev. He's a cyborg running on cybernetic brain programs with the most sophisticated software yet devised. But it's still software. That's all it is.
Dev stared at him for a long moment. You really believe that, don't you?
It's the truth, Dev.
Have you tried telling that to Steel?
No, of course not. Gates said, it's important to the project that for Steel to function at optimal levels, he needs to believe he's human. And it's important for him to be perceived that way in terms of public relations as well. It wouldn't go over very well if the public perceived what we were doing as turning dead people into robots. So, for the record, Steel is human, okay? But that doesn't change the facts. A program is a program. Software is nothing more than software. It isn't self-aware, and certainly isn't alive. It's merely got some sort of glitch in it. That's all. We'll pull it and fix it.
No, said Dev.
What do you mean, no? You just said yourself you're afraid Steel's personality might be fragmenting. We need to find the glitch and correct it before the project can get any worse.
I don't think you can correct it, Dev said.
Look, Dev, with all due respect, you're not a cybernetics engineer.
You're not a therapist, said Dev. You're looking at this thing with an engineer's mentality, Phil, saying things in simple, logical terms of black and white, but the subconscious isn't logical. We're dealing with a lot of gray areas. How can you be sure that if you tinker with the program and eliminate this glitch, as you put it, you won't also eliminate some very fundamental part of Steel's personality?
So what if we do? Said Gates. We'll compensate for it, so long as his ability to function remains unimpaired. Damn it, Phil! You just don't understand. Steel isn't a machine. You don't even realize the significance of what you've achieved. You didn't simply write some kind of complicated computer program. You downloaded human mental engrams and loaded them into an artificial brain. You've effected an intelligence transplant. No artificial intelligence, but human intelligence. You sat here and you listened to me interact with that program. You heard how the program responded. How can you deny that it's alive and self-aware? How can you fail to accept it?
Or maybe you don't want to accept it. Dev continued, suddenly struck by the insight. Maybe seeing Steel as a machine is what keeps you from having to grapple with the philosophical implications of what you've done. That makes it simple for you, doesn't it? The whole thing is reduced to an engineering problem, mechanical and mathematical problems and solutions. The human element doesn't simply enter into it. Only Susan Carmody didn't feel that way about him, did she? She fell in love with him. You telling me that she fell in love with a machine? Gates did not respond for a long moment. Finally, he said,
Dr. Carmody was under a great deal of pressure.
So what are you saying? That she relieved her tensions with the most sophisticated sex toy ever made, said Dev, or that she committed high-tech necrophilia?
You don't have to be crude, said Gates with a grimace.
I'll be anything I have to in order to get through to you, said Dev. He pointed to the computer. That program is alive, and Steel is in trouble. And it's trouble you can't resolve with an engineering fix. You didn't write that program, Gates. Nature did. You just moved it from one place to another. And you managed to disrupt it in the process. Now I'm the one who's going to have to fix it. And I don't know how I'm going to do it. I'm trying to deal with schizophrenia, with neurosis, with delusional systems of disbelief. Only what Steel is experiencing is not delusional. It's real. That woman named Donna and those three children and that dog are not figments of his imagination. They're real. Or they were real to someone, perhaps to several people. And now they're as real to him as well because they're a part of him. Donna is his wife because he was married to someone whose downloaded mental engrams were used to supplement Steel's matrix. He knows her, yet he doesn't know her. She's a part of him, and yet he's never even met her. He's experiencing someone else's memory, only it's now become his memory as well, his experience, only it never happened to him. And if I can't find a way to help him resolve that in his mind, it's going to drive him crazy. Gates stared at the melting ice in his glass. He didn't know what to think. His mind was in turmoil.
I'm not sure about any of this, he said. I don't know what's happening, but whatever it is, Higgins will have to be told about this immediately.
No, absolutely not, said Dev. I cannot allow it.
What do you mean you can't allow it? Gates said. It isn't your decision. Higgins has to know.
We can't pass the buck on this one, Phil, said Dev. Unloading it on Higgins won't do either of us any good, and it certainly won't do Steel any good. What can Higgins do? He'll hit the ball right back into your court. He'll
pill steal in and order us to work together to debug his program. Only that's not the way to solve this problem. We can't simply erase it. Maybe you can, but I can't sit still for it. Steele is still my patient and I have a responsibility to him.
You're not the only one who's got responsibilities, you know, said Gates. I've got to answer to Higgins. I can't keep something like this from him. I'm sorry, Dev. I simply can't. I've got to tell him.
I'll have you brought up on charges of violating security by giving me an unauthorized copy of top-secret government data, Dev said. Gates snorted.
Don't be a fool. You're just as guilty of violating security as I am. You'll be throwing yourself right into the fire with me.
I don't care. I'm willing to take my chances. Are you? Gates stared at him.
You'd really do that?
Try me.
You son of a bitch. And I thought you were my friend.
I am your friend, Phil, and I'm sorry. I truly am, but you're putting me in a position where I have no other choice. Ethically, I'm bound to protect my patient, and if you force my hand, I'm willing to go up to the wall on this one. Gates signed with resignation.
All right, what do you want from me?
I need your help, Phil. As you said, I'm not a cybernetics engineer, and you're not a psychiatrist. But between the two of us, maybe we can find a way to stop what's happening to Steele. Dev turned to the computer, and maybe he can help us do it.
He?
Said Gates. That's right, Phil, he, said Dev, staring at the backup copy of the program still loaded into the computer. God help him. It was getting late, and Ice had left to go on his own apartment downstairs. They had been listening to Raven for hours, with Steele asking countless questions, trying to find out everything she knew about the Borodinis.
You gotta promise me one thing,
said Raven, sitting at the table across from Steele, a drink in front of her.
When you go up against the Borodinis, I want to be there.
Forget it, Steele said.
But I can help you.
But you can also get yourself killed, said Steele.
I can take care of myself.
Look, after what Tommy B did to you, I can appreciate how you feel, said Steele. But I'm going to have my hands full as it is. You'll slow us down, and I can't be worrying about you.
I didn't ask you to worry about me,
she said.
Why should you care anyway? Just give me a gun and I'll look out for myself.
If you want to commit suicide, that's your business, Steele said. But I'm not going to help you do it.
Damn it, Steele,
The phone rang. Steele went to pick it up.
I don't want to discuss it, he said. Hello?
Steele, Ron Jaworski, over at the project. Dr. Gates had me assemble a file for you on the Borodini family.
Right. You got it for me?
I've got it. I can let you have a high-speed download. You ready?
Go ahead.
Hold on a sec. Okay, here comes.
Data hummed through the receiver with a soft, barely audible whine as Steele listened, his cybernetic brain taking the download and recording it. Seconds later, a high-pitched tone indicated that the run was complete. The tech came back on the line.
You got it?
I've got it, thanks.
Will you be needing anything else, or can I clock out now?
No, that'll be all right for tonight. Go home, Jaworski, and thanks again.
No problem. Anytime.
Steele hung up the phone. He knew everything that was officially known about the Borodinis and their enclave, but Raven had told him some things that weren't in any file. He turned around.
There's still some things I haven't told you,
she said.
Things you'll need to know, but I won't tell you anymore unless you promise that you'll take me with you.
Fine, said Steele. Have it your way. You can pack your things. I'll call security and have them let you out. Thanks for the help.
She stared at him.
You bastard! You're not kicking me out of here! You told me I could help!
It's up to you, said Steele. You cooperate, you can stay. You start giving me ultimatums, the door's right over there.
Her expression softened, and she came over to him.
I want to stay,
she said.
I want to help you. I just want to see Tommy Beast get what's coming to him.
She took his hand and lifted it up to her lips.
I can help you, Steele,
she said.
We could be good together.
She gazed into his eyes and slipped his index finger into her mouth. She tongued it gently as her fingertips caressed his palm. Then her expression changed.
What's this?
Her stroking fingertips had found the gun port on his palm. She looked at it, puzzled, then glanced up at him.
What is that?
By way of reply, Steele slid the gun barrel out through his palm. She jerked back, dropping his hand.
What the hell?
She stared at him, then at his hand. He held it out so she could see it.
Is that a gun?
She asked. Steele nodded.
You've got a gun built into your arm?
He switched on his laser designator and his eyes glowed with two bright pinpricks of light. Raven slowly backed away from him.
Jesus fucking Christ! What the hell are you?
Still think we could be good together, Raven?
He retracted the gun barrel, then released the lock on his right hand. As it dropped off, he caught it with his left hand and tossed it to her.
You want a pacifier? Here, take it with you.
She instinctively caught the hand, then cried out and dropped it to the floor. She stared at it wide-eyed, lying at her feet, then looked up at Steele, her jaw slack.
You're a fucking robot?
She said with disbelief.
I'm a cyborg, Steele said. Don't you watch the news or read the papers?
She shook her head, stunned.
What? What the hell's a cyborg? You some kind of machine?
Part machine, part human, Steele said.
She raised her arm hesitantly and pointed at his eyes.
Turn that off, will ya? It's weird.
The lights in Steele's eyes winked out. She stared at him, shaking her head slowly.
Jesus. Jesus, God.
She knelt down and carefully picked up his hand, examining it.
It feels so real.
Nice steel and polymer, he said, with sophisticated nerve sensors built in.
I can't believe it,
she said softly, awestruck. She glanced up at him with astonishment.
You mean somebody built you?
Not exactly, Steele said. I was a cop. Borodini's people ambushed me and left me for dead, but they didn't quite finish the job. I was brain damaged, in a coma. The feds took me and fixed me up, using some artificial parts. Then they took all the information from my brain and loaded it into a computer. Then they stuck it in my skull. My skeletal structure was reinforced with nice steel alloy. My arms and legs are state-of-the-art, fusion-powered nice steel prosthetics with built-in weapon systems. And my polymer skin makes me almost completely bulletproof. My skull casing is nice steel and can take a hit that would kill an ordinary man. But you're not bulletproof, are you? You see why I don't want you involved.
She came up to him hesitantly and gave him back his hand. She couldn't take her eyes off the gleaming nice steel armature exposed at his wrist and the 10mm gun barrel that protruded from it slightly. Steele snapped his hand back on and it locked into place. She gazed up into his eyes.
Are they...
artificial, Steele said. Bionic optics units. What you just saw was the built-in laser designator system that lets me lock on target. I can't miss. I'm like a walking tank, Raven. I'm very hard to kill. Can you say the same for yourself?
She reached up carefully and touched his face.
Is that fake?
No, that's real,
Steele said. Her hand went down to his open shirt and touched his chest.
And that?
That's polymer, he said. It's a sort of plastic skin graft. The ribs underneath are nice steel alloy, but the organs and the muscles are all real.
She gently stroked his chest with her fingernails.
Can you feel that?
Yes, I can feel it. I feel things the same way you do. And I think the same way as you do, too. Only I can do it much faster.
Her hand started to drop lower. He stopped her before it passed his waist. She glanced up at him, questioningly.
Yeah, that's real, too,
he said wryly.
Wow,
she said.
You mean you're like a real person, only with artificial arms and legs and stuff? Like someone who's handicapped?
I suppose you could look at it that way, said Steele. Only I've got an artificial brain as well.
Jesus, this is blowing my mind,
she said, staring at him with fascination.
How could they do that?
You know what an interface is,
asked Steele. She shook her head.
It's like when they connect up two computers so they can talk to each other,
Steele explained.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Well, they've been working on a way to interface a human brain and a computer, Steele said, so that a computer can talk to a brain and vice versa to help people learn things faster. They do it by putting a little computer chip in your head. That's what they did to me. I was working with them on an experiment in brain-computer interface. They wanted to see if the things I learned during my years as a Strike Force cop could be taken from my mind and put on a computer so that other people could learn the same things, only much faster.
Wow. And does it work?
Yeah, it works. When Borodini's people shot me up, I was taken to the project lab, and they used that little chip inside my head to take everything out of my mind and store it in a computer. Then they put an experimental computer brain into my head and programmed it with my own personality, my own memories, everything my human brain contained. So I still feel the same way I always did. I still think the same way. I still have the same memories and personality, but it's all stored inside a cybernetic brain.
Jesus, what a trip,
she said.
What's it like?
Doesn't it frighten you,
said Steele.
Hey, when it comes to some of the shit I've seen, you don't even qualify as scary. Besides, I've done tricks with people who were handicapped. What's the big deal? They're people, same as anybody else. They just got some parts missing.
Like a brain? Asked Steele.
Well, okay, yeah. I gotta admit, that's a new one on me. But I wouldn't exactly call that scary. It's pretty fucking weird, but it doesn't scare me. Why should it? You've treated me lots better than most guys I've been with.
There it was, thought Steele. Simple as that. Acceptance. He marveled at it. A woman he'd lived with for almost 20 years hadn't even tried. She'd divorced him and left the city rather than face the prospect of being married to some sort of freak and having her kids, in her own words, have some kind of robot for a father. Shelley Taylor, his best friend's sister, whom he'd known for more than 20 years, had not even been able to look him in the eyes and had been profoundly uncomfortable in his presence. Her relief when he had left had been all too painfully visible. And now this girl, who he scarcely knew at all, had seemingly accepted him for what he was in a mere matter of moments. But perhaps it was because, as she herself had said, that after some of the things she'd seen and been through, he didn't even qualify as scary. On that level, though they came from different worlds, they could understand each other. Both of them were damaged goods. Her initial response to him had been predictable, dictated by the law of the urban jungle. In her world, women were nothing more than chattel. She understood being whacked around and degraded, and in her twisted worldview, anyone not man enough to do that was either going to get victimized himself, and he deserved whatever was coming to him. It was a dog-eat-dog world, eat or be eaten, beat or be beaten. When Steele had not followed the laws of the equation, she had tried to rip him off, had even tried to kill him, but in his own way, he had asserted the law of the jungle over her, not by slapping her around as if she were a piece of meat, to which she would have responded like the animal she was, submissive in the force of violent domination. Buh. Yet ready to tear his throat out the moment his back was turned, but by a simple and direct, nonviolent assertion of his superior strength and confidence. Like a larger animal responding to a smaller, aggressive one encountered on its turf, drawing itself up and revealing its superior power without resorting to its use, laying down the law. This is my territory. You don't bother me and I won't bother you, but challenge me and I'll crush you to the ground. Boy, oh boy. And so they had achieved a sort of coexistence, sharing the same space without threatening each other. It was not exactly a relationship, but for animals, just as for some people, it was a way to live. Only Steele felt there had to be more to life than that. Tommy Borodini had a lot to answer for. You ask me what it's like, he said to her. You really want to know?
Yeah, sure, why not?
What's it like to be a hooker?
He asked. She rolled her eyes.
Oh, Christ, you're not going to be one of those, are you?
He shook his head.
You don't understand, he said. I'm not asking you how a nice girl like you got into a business like this. Besides, I already know how you got into it. I'm trying to make a point.
Yeah, what's that?
When you turn a trick with someone, what's it like? Do you feel anything for him, except perhaps contempt? Does he feel anything for you except a temporary lust? He uses you and you use him. And when it's over, neither one of you wants anything to do with one another. In some ways, it's a lot like that.
She frowned.
I don't get you. How is it the same?
People treat you the same way, Steele asked. Like you're a machine. They only care about the uses they can put you to.
He got up and wandered out into the balcony. She followed him.
There was one exception, he said. He looked down at the floor. She died right here.
What happened?
Raven asked from behind him. Steele looked at her out over the night lights of the city.
It was Borodini, he said. He tried to have me hit from a chopper.
He glanced up towards the roof.
That's why there are gun turrets up there now. They didn't manage to kill me, but they got Susan. The only person who didn't treat me as if I was some sort of robot.
What about Ice?
Asked Raven. Steele smiled.
Ice is a whole nother smoke, as my Texan shrink would say, he said. He respects me precisely because I am what I am. He's something of a machine himself in some ways. I actually think he'd like being me. Yet I'd trade places with him in a second.
That night you had the dream,
said Raven.
Was it about her? About what happened?
Steele glanced away.
No, it was something else.
He debated for a moment whether or not he should confide in her. They felt a strong need to tell someone, and there was no one else he could tell, no one except for Father Liam Casey, whom he had already overburdened with his troubles, and for whom Steele was determined to stay away until this thing with Borodini was resolved. He didn't want anyone else to die on his account.
You don't have to tell me if you don't want to,
she said. He looked at her.
No, it's okay. I want to.
The night seemed to drag on endlessly as he walked the fence along the north edge of the field, his assault rifle cradled in the crook of his elbow. The crescent moon glowed dimly in the night sky, and a cool breeze rustled through the stalks behind him. He was bored out of his mind. He joined the army expecting something a bit more glamorous than this. The enlistment officer had promised him, had guaranteed him, assignment on the armored corps, and he pictured himself in a well-worn leather bomber's jacket with a white silk scarf around his neck, riding convoy escort duty along the long stretches of deserted highway, linking the cities with the outdated settlements, guarding the precious supply runs that kept the cities fed, living the adventurous life of an armor jockey, respected and admired by the burly truck drivers and the slender, lissome, exotic dancers who entertained them at the fortified depots on the highway. Instead, he'd been assigned to an infantry unit posted to an agro commune in upstate New York. And here he was, walking his rounds in the middle of the night, guarding a fucking cornfield. In another couple of hours, it would be 0600, and his relief would arrive, and he'd trudge back to the Quonset Beck Hut barracks for a few drinks of whiskey with the other soldiers getting off their shift, and then some sack time. Real glamorous. Join the army and be a fucking night watchman. Protect the corn from crows and field mice. Jesus, what a joke. Ostensibly, it was supposed to be guarding the fields from roving bands of raiders, outlaw bands who roamed the countryside, attacking farms and outlying settlements. But no band of derelicts would dare attack a farm protected by an army unit, and there had been no reports of screamers in the area for months. There was nothing to do but pull your duty and play cards, drink, shoot the bull, and sleep. Every now and then you get a weekend pass to go into town and spend an hour or two with one of the local hookers, who charged a whole lot more than they were worth because it was a seller's market. There weren't any women in his unit, and the local girls, for the most part, steered clear of soldiers because being seen with one was a good way to get a reputation. The only guys who had any real chance of getting one were the officers, and even they had precious little chance of getting in their pants unless they came up with a ring. There were a few good-looking girls who worked the farm, but orders prohibited fraternization with the females in the work crews on the principle that it would cause trouble among the men and with the girls' families. So all you could do was stand and drool over some tight-ass country girl in a halter top and skin-tight cutoffs while she fed the chickens or worked the fields you so valiantly protected. It was enough to make a guy crazy. He glanced at his watch. God, the night was dragging. He reached into his shirt pocket and pulled out a packet of cigarettes. He lit one and inhaled deeply. You weren't supposed to smoke on guard duty, but fuck it. Half the time, the guys would sneak down among the rows of corn and kip out for a while. If you did that, there was a chance of getting caught, though the officer of the guard hardly ever came out to check the fields. Still, just to be on the safe side, he cupped his hand around the cigarette to hide its telltale glow, just in case. Hi! He spun around, startled, bringing up his gun. A young blonde in tight jeans and a faded denim skirt was leaning on the fence behind him. He recognized her as one of the girls who worked the farm, the foreman's daughter. She wore a tight t-shirt beneath the open jacket. Her nipples were clearly outlined. God, she had great tits. He hadn't even heard her come up. Jesus, you gave me a start. What are you doing out here this time of night? She shrugged. Couldn't sleep. Thought I'd take a walk. You got a spare smoke? He shook a cigarette out from the pack and offered it to her. She took it and he lit it for her. My name's Claire. I know. I've seen you around. She smiled knowingly. Yeah, I've seen you watching me. He grinned. It's hard not to. She looked straight at him. So, you like what you see? Yes, very much. I knew you'd be on guard duty tonight, she said. It's a warm night, isn't it? She slowly removed her denim jacket, stretching so that her lush, young breasts strained the fabric of the t-shirt. The effect was not lost on him. She draped the jacket over the fence. My dad would kill me if she knew I was out here talking to you, she said. What he doesn't know won't hurt him. You think I've got a nice body? I think you've got a terrific body. Then why don't you put down that gun and come on over here? He didn't need a second invitation. He leaned the assault rifle up against the fence and went up to her. He took her in his arms. Her lips felt warm and moist, and he felt the heat surge through him as she slipped her tongue into his mouth. He ran his hands up underneath her t-shirt, feeling her firm, young breasts, and she moaned softly as she dropped her hands down to his belt and started to undo it. He couldn't believe this was happening. He devoured her mouth as she unbuttoned his fly and slipped her hand down inside his shorts. He groaned as he felt her fingers close around his shaft and starts stroking rhythmically. His fingers fumbled with the buttons on her jeans. Then she pulled away from him and with a knowing smile, slowly went down to her knees. He closed his eyes and moaned as she took him in her mouth. Fuck. For a brief instant, paranoia surged through him as he thought about what would happen if they were caught together. Oh, God damn it. An underage teenage girl, the foreman's daughter, no less. And he didn't care as he felt her warm mouth enveloping him. As she sucked him, she pulled his pants down around his ankles and then urged him down into the ground. She kneeled over him, pulled off her t-shirt, then stood and quickly removed her jeans. She wasn't wearing anything underneath. She straddled him, slipped him inside her, and started rocking back and forth, moving her pelvis against him, her face tilted backwards, her eyes closed, her mouth open as she made soft, groaning sounds. There was a brief hissing noise as the arrow pierced her chest with a sound like a hammer striking meat. The razor-sharp triangular head came plowing through her back and burst through her chest, between her breasts. Warm blood splattered down on his face. Her eyes opened wide and she made a grunting sound and fell forward onto his chest. He cried out as the sharp arrowhead protruding from her chest broke his skin, and he struggled to push her off him, but she was dead weight and he was pinned. He heard the sounds of running footsteps coming up fast, and in a panic he rolled, dislodging her body, and scrambled for his rifle. With his pants down around his ankles, he tripped and fell sprawling, then crawled forward and quickly on his hands and knees, the adrenaline trip hammering through him. A shot cracked out and he felt a bullet graze his shoulder. He cried out in pain and his hand closed around the rifle stock, and then they were on him. Steele sat up in bed with a start, crying out.
It's okay, it's okay,
Raven said, her hands on his shoulders.
It was just another nightmare, that's all. You're all right now.
Steele shut his eyes and exhaled briefly. She put her arms around him and held him close.
It's okay, baby,
she said, stroking his hair.
It's okay.
I woke you up again. I'm sorry.
It's all right. I'm a light sleeper anyway. Was it the same dream?
He pulled away from her.
No, he said, frowning. This one was different.
What was it?
I was a soldier, he said. I was walking guard duty on some farm in upstate New York, watching a cornfield. There was a girl, a very young girl, the foreman's daughter. She came out to the field looking for me. We talked for a while, and then we started making love.
Doesn't sound like too bad of a dream,
said Raven, smiling.
She died, said Steele. She was kneeling on top of me, and someone shot her with a bow and arrow. The arrow came right through her chest. She fell down on me. There was blood everywhere.
Jesus.
Outlaw raiders, Steele said. They were after the corn.
What happened?
I don't know. I scrambled for my rifle, and just as I got to it, I was hit.
His hand went up to his shoulder.
That's it. Then I woke up.
This ever happened to you?
She asked. Steele shook his head.
No, I was never in the army. I've never been to upstate New York. I've never even seen a cornfield. But it happened to someone. And whoever he was, he must have lived through it. Otherwise, I wouldn't have the memory.
You think it was the same person who was married to Donna and had the three kids?
Asked Raven.
No, it didn't feel the same. This was someone different. A young kid. The memory was much stronger.
He took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
Christ! I've got fucking ghosts inside me. They're part of my goddamn mind.
Raven put her arms around him and pulled him close.
What are you going to do?
I don't know, he said, holding her. I just don't know. If I tell them, they'll put me down again and go into my brain. Try to debug the program. I might not come out the same.
Okay,
she said, kissing him on the neck.
Okay, then we just won't tell them. Well, I won't say a thing. We'll handle this together. We'll get through it. I'll be here for you. I promise.
He pulled away from her and looked into her eyes. For a moment, they simply stared at one another. Then she leaned forward, put her hand on his cheek, and gently kissed his lips. Once, twice, three times. The fourth time, he hugged her close, and she moved up against him, slipping her tongue into his mouth. He pulled her down into the bed, and they kissed hungrily. Then her head moved down to his chest, her lips caressing him gently, her tongue flicking out to touch his nipples lightly. She moved down lower and Steele moaned softly as the tip of her tongue touched him, and then her lips softly slid down over him. He pulled her around and buried his head between her long, slim legs. They lay locked together for a while, and then she turned around and pulled him over on top of her. As he entered her, she gasped, looked up to him, and softly said,
I love you.
And he believed it. End of chapter.